abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Wednesday, February 19th, 2014. Thanks for listening to The Tom Woods Show, which is the number one rated libertarian podcast on iTunes. Thanks to you listeners. Today, we are talking to Dr. Michael Humer, professor of philosophy at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Professor Humer holds a bachelor's degree in philosophy from the University of California at Berkeley, his PhD from Rutgers University. He's the author of four books, most recently, The Problem of Political Authority, An Examination of the Right to Coerce and the Duty to Obey. This book is going to blow your mind. It is my pleasure to welcome to the program right now, Michael Humer. Michael Humer, thanks for spending some time with us today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, you have got a book, The Problem of Political Authority, that I think breaks new ground in the way it attacks a very, very important question. And, of course, it's a question that so often goes unexamined. Well, thanks to John Simmons, it goes slightly less unexamined. But you subject it to relentless scrutiny in this book. So before we get into the details of your arguments in the different chapters, I want you to take a minute to explain to the audience the overall project that you're engaged in and how you go about it.
Yeah, well, there's this question about the nature of political authority, and political authority is a kind of hypothetical moral property that the state allegedly has, which gives it a kind of different moral status from all other agents. Political authority is supposed to explain why it's permissible for the state to do all kinds of things that are not permissible for any other agent. So if I have a charity that I want to collect money for, it's not considered permissible for me to collect it by force. I can't go out and extort people and, you know, threaten to imprison people if they don't contribute to my charity, even if it's a really good charity. But the state is allowed to do that. And so there's a philosophical question of why they should be allowed to do that and nobody else is. Right? And so a theory of authority is supposed to explain things like that. At the same time, it's supposed to explain why we should obey the state when we wouldn't have to obey anyone else. If somebody else tells you, don't take these drugs because they're bad for you, it's generally thought that you don't have to obey them. But most people think that you have to obey the state when they tell you not to take certain drugs. Right.
So, in other words, we sort of have come to accept the idea that there's a double standard at work, that we all have to obey a certain moral code that we sort of intuitively recognize, and yet we, at the same time, are willing to let the state get away with brazenly violating this all the time. Now, let me skip ahead to the very end of your book. Where are you ultimately, I hate to give away the punchline for everybody, but I want them to know where you're headed. Where is this argument ultimately going to take you and the reader?
Yeah, so by the end of the book, I've defended anarcho-capitalism. So basically, I think that we don't need a state. The first half of the book is about why political authority is an illusion, that the state doesn't really have a different moral status from anyone else. The second half of the book is about how you could have a society that doesn't have a central authority structure and how it could work out okay.
Now, as I said before we went on the air, I think I'd like to have you come back on another time and take on that section of the book, because I've had Gary Chartier on in the past, I've had David Friedman. You know, the program is no stranger to these topics, but you have a very good take on it, and I want people to be exposed to it. But I want to do justice to the arguments that you make. Let me just say in parentheses, though, that I wonder what you would have to say to Brian Kaplan's criticism. I mean, he loves your book, But his criticism of your book is that it's too abrupt. I mean, on the one hand, maybe people are willing to accept that your arguments against political authority are sound, but then pushing them right away into the deep end of anarcho-capitalism maybe is too abrupt. Maybe you needed to make the more moderate case first and then say, oh, and by the way, security services and legal services can be provided too. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, maybe. Yeah, Brian's main criticism of my book is sort of that there's not enough of it.
It's not a bad criticism, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, the first half of the book is supposed to get you to moderate libertarianism, like the minimal state. The second half of the book is supposed to get you the rest of the way. So if you only read the first half, then you wouldn't be shocked by the... Well, actually, most people would still be shocked. But,
right.
But ordinary libertarians would not be shocked. Because the result of there not being political authority is not that you have to immediately abolish the state and all of its functions. The result is simply that the state has to operate by the same rules as everyone else. So the result, if you only read the first half of the book, the result is that the state shouldn't interfere with any behavior that it would not be permissible for a non-state agent to interfere with.
All right, so that really... I think brings us to one of the key points of your book, which is that you're not going to spend time in this book focused on maybe the traditional libertarian approach of talking about the non-aggression principle and then applying it in various situations, but rather a kind of, now forgive me as a non-philosopher if I'm using terms incorrectly, but maybe a kind of a maybe moral intuitionism, maybe the idea that certainly there are some moral principles that at least on a basic level, seem to be shared by almost everybody, and if we can appeal to those, the same way Robert Nozick in Anarchy, State, and Utopia appeals to the idea that forced labor is wrong. I don't need to draw you a diagram about that. If I can show you that what this is that the state is doing is akin to forced labor, then I've made my case. Is that the kind of angle you're taking?
Yeah, so, well, my approach is a little more, I guess, concrete and specific than most libertarian arguments. I'm not claiming to have a general moral theory that tells you when any action is permissible or not. Many libertarians rely on this non-aggression principle as a kind of universal axiom. What I'm doing is relying upon judgments that people would make in a concrete situation. So if I go to my neighbor next door and, you know, I bring my gun there and I demand that he contribute a certain amount of money to my charity, almost everyone will agree that that's wrong. We might not agree about why that's wrong, right? So there are different moral principles that somebody could advance to explain why that's wrong, but almost everyone agrees that I can't do that. And then the strategy of argument is to just see, you know, show how there's an analogy between that and something that the state is doing, namely taxation. Right? So I don't have to give a complete moral theory. And I think that this is an advantage of the approach.
Well, let's start going through some of the beginning of the book, because there, when you're talking about social contract theory, although you're talking about it the way a philosopher would, these are arguments that to a lay audience will sound familiar, because they are objections that on a lower level the average libertarian encounters all the time on Facebook with friends and family. And the way you would boil it down, and the way you would see it in sort of ordinary conversation, would be: look, you obviously benefit from the state, and if you didn't like it here, you might as well leave. But the fact that you're here and you're enjoying the benefits indicates that you have implicitly or tacitly consented. So we're all familiar with this sort of argument. And it always struck me that this is one of the weakest arguments I think I've ever heard on behalf of anything, and yet it has such purchase on the public mind. How do you respond to it?
Yeah. Well, you know, so... going with the analogy strategy, right? Let's say that the mafia has taken control of your neighborhood, right? And they're extorting money from you. And you say to the mafia boss, please stop extorting money from me. This is wrong. And the mafia says, well, you know, you live in this neighborhood. We control the neighborhood and you live here, so you're agreeing to have us extort money from you, right? Well, if the mafia, like if somebody actually owns the neighborhood legitimately, right, like they had acquired a property right by one of the accepted legitimate methods, and then they said, if you move in here, then you have to agree to this, and then you sign the contract and move in. You know, then they'd have an argument that they can do whatever the contract said they could do. But what you can't do is go to somebody who's living on their own property, which they own, and tell them that they have to move out of their property if they don't agree to your terms, right? You don't have the right to just set terms on other people's use of their own property, right?
Yeah, that's the key thing, because I've had somebody raise an objection that if there were somewhere in the world a libertarian society, you know, Somalia is the one that's always thrown at us. But, you know, if there were a place without a state, we as libertarians would be morally obligated to move there. And But I don't see why we would, because, as you say, if I own this property, I get to establish the rules on my property. And for somebody else to come along and start badgering me, that person is the bully. Why would the bully have the moral benefit of the doubt?
Yeah, so, you know, you might say, no, the state should leave, right?
Yeah, that's exactly my thought.
I and the state are not in agreement with each other. Why don't they leave the territory?
That argument has never worked, however, in practice. But in terms of the strict logic of it, I don't see what the problem is. Now, you're also talking in the book about a sort of hypothetical social contract. I mean, here, I suppose we're talking about the veil of ignorance, the original position, the sort of thing that John Rawls might have advanced. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, right. So, you know, after philosophers figure out that, well, there's no actual social contract, nobody actually agreed to it, then they move to, well, maybe you would have agreed to it in some hypothetical scenario, right?
Right.
It's a little hard to see how that's supposed to give any moral force. So here's an example. Let's say you're a doctor in a hospital and an accident victim has just been brought in. The accident victim needs immediate medical care. However, he is unconscious. Now, normally you need somebody's consent in order to give them medical care, but you can't get this person's consent. So what do you do? Okay, and the answer is, well, you give them the medical care anyway. And the rationale for this is, well, it's reasonable to assume that they would consent if they were able. Mm. Because most people would consent, you know, okay, and it's really genuinely necessary and so on. So, all right, so there's the efficacy of hypothetical consent. But this isn't going to work for the state and the social contract. It's not going to work for the state to say, well, you would have consented to have us. So, first of all, in the case of the unconscious accident victim, it's actually important that the victim is unconscious. If the victim is conscious, then you have to ask them. You can't just say, well, you would have consented if I had asked you, right? Citizens of modern governments are not all unconscious. The government could ask them if they consent. The government chooses not to ask them because they're afraid of what the response would be.
Yeah, there you go.
If the consequence of your saying, no, I don't agree, would be that you would have zero tax liability, then quite a lot of people would say, no, I don't agree, and then they would get the complete tax refund, right? The other problem with the hypothetical consent theories is that when the philosopher argues that you would consent, they do that with a counterfactual assumption that your beliefs and values were different from what they actually are. Because there are certain people, namely, like most libertarians, who would not consent, or at least would not consent if they knew what the government was going to be like. So, in order to make the argument that hypothetically we would consent to the state, you have to either just ignore the libertarians or hypothetically assume that the libertarians had different beliefs than what they actually had, right? And this doesn't really work. Like, in the appeal to hypothetical consent, it should be based upon the person's actual philosophical beliefs and values.
And, you know, speaking of ignoring the libertarians, it's interesting that John Rawls, during his public life, you know, his life as a professor, seemed quite willing to engage people who disagreed with him, let's say, from a more left-wing perspective. I mean, I don't know if he ever interacted with Cohen, the Marxist philosopher, but people like that he was at least willing to talk to, whereas you don't see a full-fledged response to a libertarian critique of Rawls. Now, can you just tell us a little bit about what was Rawls doing? Like, what was wrong with his whole approach? Because there does seem to be a superficial plausibility to it, that if I were behind a veil of ignorance and I didn't know if I was going to be male or female or rich or poor or black or white or talented or untalented, maybe I would say, well, then, since I might wind up being the lowest of the low, then the rule I would want governing society is that we should be as, you know, as equal as possible, so that even if I am the lowest of the low, I won't be so low. Like, what's the problem there? Because there, as I say, there seems to be some superficial plausibility to it.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, so, you know, here's another hypothetical. Let's say there's a lottery, and there's one particular ticket that if you have it, you win $1 million, and then the other tickets, you know, are all worth nothing. So I bought this lottery ticket. Suppose that I just found out that it's the winner. It's worth $1 million. And then you come up to me and you say, you know, Mike, you paid $3 for this lottery ticket. If you didn't know that it was a winner, you would be happy to sell it to me for $10, right? So you should sell it to me for $10. Wrong. Right. Now, if I didn't know that it was a winner, I would sell it to you for $10. That's completely irrelevant once I do know. And once I do know that it's a winner, of course I'm not going to sell it. And there's no argument from justice that I'm morally obligated to sell it either, right? No, I'm not obligated to sell it. It's not unjust for me to keep it. And so this is kind of analogous. If I'm in society and I found out that I'm one of the winners, so to speak, that is, I'm wealthy, I have talents that are socially valuable, so I'm in a good position. It might be true that I would have agreed to massive wealth redistribution if I didn't know that I was going to be one of the winners. But that doesn't mean that in actual fact I should or am obligated to agree to the wealth redistribution once I know that I'm one of the winners, right?
But they could say to you, the talent that you have, or even the very fact that, I mean, it could be a talent that you have to really work to cultivate, but the very fact that you have these this work ethic is also something that's unmerited and undeserved. Since you don't deserve it, surely you should, as a morally reasonable person, want to share the fruits of it with people who don't have this beneficial endowment.
Yeah, right? Also irrelevant, right? So, I mean, it's a controversial claim that you don't deserve your talents, right? That you don't even deserve the talents that you work to cultivate. That's controversial, but it's irrelevant because you could take the clearest case of something that I don't deserve, and I'm still not obligated to compensate other people. That's why the lottery example is good. Because the fact that I won the lottery, that's just the clearest case of random fortune, right? Clearly, I didn't deserve to win the lottery. It was just good luck. But I'm still not obligated to give away the money, right? So when you come to the controversial case where maybe my talents are a matter of luck or maybe I'm responsible for them, maybe not, you know, even more clearly, I'm not obligated to give away the fruits that result from that, right?
But I wonder, what would Rawls say about a lottery ticket? I mean, would he say that to some degree the difference principle requires that you give away at least some of that money?
Well, I'm not sure because, of course, that would kind of, well, you do have to give away some of it to taxes. But not clear what he would say, like, should the state take away all the lottery money? Of course, that would just defeat the point of having lottery. I think that Rawls's response to most of my hypotheticals would be, well, my philosophical principles only apply to the general political structure of society, and they don't apply to cases involving individual people. Okay, so if there's an example involving just two individuals, my principles don't apply, so you can't use an analogy.
Okay. And he also said the same sort of thing when you're dealing with one country versus another, that he's not willing to apply the difference principle when you're dealing with the Democratic Republic of the Congo and the United States, which it seems to be morally arbitrary, although Thomas Nagel tries to rescue him from that, but that's getting us a little bit off topic. Let me ask you about an objection that I think a lot of American school children might have to what you're saying, and that would be we live in a democratic society and we all collectively decided that people should be able to get a chunk of the fruits of your talents or your lottery winnings or whatever, and we all freely decided that, and you're part of that, and you know you had your equal say, and it just came out the other way, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. Well, usually the mere fact that a larger number of people wants to do something than the number who are opposed to it doesn't mean that they have the right to do it, right? So if there's some behavior that would normally violate somebody's rights, it doesn't cease to be a rights violation just because more people support it than oppose it. So, for example, you know, I go out for drinks with some of my friends, and at the end, you know, after we've all run up a big tab, the question arises as to who's going to pay for it. And suppose that a majority of my friends vote that I should pay for everyone, and I'm the only one who disagrees, right? You know, five people want me to pay for everyone, only I don't want to pay for everyone.
Right.
Am I obligated to pay for everyone? No. Are they ethically entitled to force me to pay for them? No. So it's really unclear how the appeal to the opinion of the majority makes any difference, right? And this is just, you know, and it could be just like a few dollars and they still don't have the right to take my money, right? So, you know, it looks like majority will has very little moral force.
And yet people treat it, though, with like a religious reverence. I mean, there are almost religious trappings around the process of voting. It's like a sacrament for some people. And yet, as you say, when you look at it closely, what is it supposed to mean that more people want to do something than don't want to do it? Well, there are a lot of moral outrages that have occurred over the centuries that many more people wanted to engage in or connive at than not.
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes the majority is right. Sometimes they're wrong. But, you know, if the fact that a majority of people support something isn't very strong evidence that it's right, you know. The fact that a narrow majority of people want drugs to be illegal really shouldn't change my mind and make me think that, oh, yeah, I guess drug use is really wrong.
Well, let me jump in with, I guess, what will probably be my last question as we wrap up here. But I guess the answer to this question really requires the second part of your book, really, which is the discussion of the stateless society and how it would work and answering objections that a lot of people maybe have, but I think a lot of people think so little about anarchism, they're not even really sure what the objections are. They just know that it would be crazy and people would be getting shot all the time and all that. And you take that on pretty well. But the key objection I think a lot of people would ultimately have, once you've broken down all these other objections, the key one that would remain with them is, even if I accept that what you're saying is right, that the state doesn't have a moral leg to stand on, if it turns out that the only way for civilized life to be possible is under the authority of the state, then you can take your highfalutin philosophical arguments and go take a hike, because we need the state to make civilized life possible.
Yeah. So, yeah, as you say, I mean, the second half of the book deals with the question of whether you really need the state to make civilized life possible. Of course, the answer turns out to be no, but that's a long story. But even if you didn't buy the second half of the book, there are still significant consequences of rejecting political authority. The consequence is not that you have to. So if you think that there's going to be some big disaster if we don't have the state, then we don't have to abolish the state. But still, the state would have to be much more limited than most states, in fact, are. Right. So if the state is necessary to prevent constant violence, then it's permissible for the state to do the minimum activities necessary to prevent that violence. But it's not permissible for them to go on and do all of these other things, you know, regulating drug use, having a space program, support for the arts, and all of these programs that are not actually necessary for that central function.
Now, Michael, looking over your CV, you have written in a wide variety of areas of philosophy. And now with this book, you've got a lot of attention from libertarians. I suppose probably in your previous books, you did not get an invitation to speak at Pork Fest. So this is an unusual thing. Do you intend to carry on further developing this theme, or do you have interests in philosophy that are going to take you elsewhere in the future?
You know, I don't know what I'm going to work on, because I just find something interesting and start doing it. I find new things every year. Certainly, I'll do some more political philosophy things, some applied ethics, and more epistemology also. You know, I have a project about, or I have a paper that I'm working on now about legal ethics, about why or whether it's permissible for a lawyer to defend someone that he knows is guilty, and questions surrounding that.
Nice. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, the book here is The Problem of Political Authority, An Examination of the Right to Coerce and the Duty to Obey. We will link to it in the show notes for this episode, and I hope we can have you on sometime to talk about the even more controversial, if you thought this part of the book was controversial, wait till you hear the rest of it. Michael Humer, thanks for being our guest today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
All right, everybody, a couple quick announcements before we get out of here. Yesterday was the 100th episode of The Tom Woods Show with Judge Andrew Napolitano as our guest. Or so I thought, and then my producer reminded me that although I did factor in our Christmas break and calculating how many programs we'd had, I forgot that we didn't have a show on Thanksgiving. So there are two different ways to approach this here. We could either say that Michael Humer was our special guest for our 100th episode, which apparently was today. Or we say yesterday was the 100th episode after all, because on Thanksgiving we had a spiritual episode, right? We were all giving thanks for the show on that day, and that in some spiritual way counted as an episode. However you want to reconcile this in your own minds, I'm at peace with it. Tomorrow on this program, we're getting an update on Bitcoin. What is going on with all these items in the news? We're going to sort it out with our friend Eric Voorhees. And remember, you guys are helping us stay on the air. You're helping me pay my bills here in the little Tom Woods Show office that I have. Every time you enter Amazon through the little Amazon widget at TomWoodsRadio.com. At no cost to you, you help us out. I sure appreciate that. Hope you guys are enjoying the show. See you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.